Hello, I'm Rob Kemp. This is number 0301, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0301. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, we have a return visit from NASA historian Rod Pyle, who this time around talks about the recent mystery shuttle launch.
It was really a mystery when it started. It's a little less of a mystery now, but this is an Air Force craft, and the Air Force has been trying to get a winged spacecraft up since about 1959. It's about a quarter the size of the space shuttle we all know, a small unmanned shuttle that sits on top of a rocket instead on the side, inside a fairing, and goes up and deploys, and it can stay up there for over a year, which is really pretty wild when you think about it. And then it comes down and lands itself Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, and they hose it off, clean it up, and check everything, and launch it again.
Terry Lizelle, author of The Millennial Woman, on a career working freelance jobs. What made her write this book?
We were just coming out from the Great Recession. It was difficult to get a job. Most millennials are actually the most educated generation in history, but we're still stuck. So I pretty much fought my way out of it and came out on top and wrote my book to help people from getting stuck. Unstuck.
Research psychologist Dr. Frieda Birnbaum is back on the show and talks about whether it's a good idea or not to friend your boss on Facebook.
It's a really difficult question. It's not as obvious as it looks because it really does depend on the climate of the workplace. So if it's something where it's accepted, if you and your boss get along, if you don't want to feel that you need to hide something that you don't want to reveal about your personal life. All this comes into play because, you know, you become an open book when you do something like this. So it can get you closer together, or it can reveal things about you that you may not want to be revealed.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0301 was Rob Kemp, the weekend host at Montreal's Spirit of Rock, Shome 97.7. You can hear his show Saturdays and Sundays from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Thank you very much, Rob, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, or as we like to call you, Captain Kemp, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A South Korean teacher is facing child abuse charges for allegedly eating a live hamster in front of his students to teach them how dear life is. Police say the 44-year-old teacher, identified by the surname Hugh, allegedly chewed a live hamster and swallowed it May 11th at a boarding school in Jeonju-ip while seven children were present. Hugh, who also allegedly used abusive language in front of the students, allegedly told police that he caught students abusing hamsters and wanted to teach them how dear life is by making them watch him eat one of the rodents. Police said Hugh left the facility after complaints from colleagues and was arrested after parents of the students contacted authorities. Hugh was charged with child abuse and released from custody. The teacher publicly apologized to the children and their parents. "I couldn't control the situation and I couldn't stand it," he told a local news agency. "While watching the hamsters die from teasing, I thought I should teach the children that it was wrong to make light of life." Okay. You said he would not have eaten the hamster if he had known his actions would be considered child abuse. Well, did he ever think that it might be hamster abuse? How about that? Now, I know what you're thinking, and the answer is, tastes like chicken. Meanwhile, an Icelandic public TV network aired 24 hours of live sheep birthing to give the country's residents insight into the traditional farming life. RUV, the Icelandic National Broadcasting Service, ran a live feed from a farm from noon Thursday until noon Friday to bring the lambing season to living rooms across the country. The sheep birthing season is an unforgettable time for those able to see the little lambs being born into the world, RUV said on its website. The broadcaster also kept up with the action on Twitter, posting a series of pictures from the lambing marathon. The event was inspired by slow television broadcasts by Norwegian public TV network NRK, which previously aired a 12-hour knitting marathon. Gee, I wonder where they got the wool from. And a 12-hour program on wood burning, and also a 100-hour marathon of chess. I wonder what the commercials are like during the lamb birthing programming. I'm guessing not a lot of butchers. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe a lot of butchers. Who knows? I have no idea. Moving right along, travelers at North Carolina's Charlotte Douglas International Airport said a man stripped naked in the concourse because he was mad about an overbooked flight. Witnesses said the man became angry when he was told his U.S. Airways flight to Jamaica was overbooked, leading him to strip nude and stand in the concourse without a stitch on his body for about 40 minutes. One traveler, Sherry Ketchy, shared photos of the naked man standing among the passengers, which included children. I seen some people running, and I was wondering what they were running from, and people were standing there snickering, so I walked over, and an airport employee told me that the man was angry over the Jamaican flight, Ketchy told reporters. Charlotte Mecklenburg police said the man was taken to a hospital for evaluation. Yes, a checkup from the neck up. You know, I'll bet all the passengers were extremely glad that this guy went squirrely while he was still on the ground. I mean, what if he wasn't happy with, say, I don't know, a pillow on the flight? Would he have stripped down at 35,000 feet, running up and down the aisle with all his naughty bits flapping in the breeze, and at eye level of the sitting passengers? You see my point here? Plus, if you're going to have a floor show, it's best to have it at the airport where one really needs to pass the time with something, okay? And speaking of airports, I got one more story I want to share with you in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. 26-year-old Chris Haynes was pretty easy to spot as a suspicious person at the airport in Tallahassee, Florida. First, it was just before 4 a.m., and no planes were scheduled to depart until around 6 a.m. Second, he pulled into a drop-off area in his car, which he left unattended. And third, he was sprinting down the hallway at the airport claiming that he had a plane to catch, and he was only clad in his underwear. A security officer yelled at Haynes to stop, and when he didn't, the officer said he'd tase him with his stun gun. Haynes allegedly kept running, so the officer tased him and took him into custody in the main concourse. Haynes, who didn't have a plane ticket, provided a possible motive to the officer after his arrest. He said, "I kinda always wanted to be tased." Well, let's hope it met all of his expectations and it lived up to the electrifying experience that he oh so longed for. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. NASA historian Rod Pyle is back on the show, this time to talk about a couple of items involving space exploration. One is Scott Kelly's year in space, and the other involves a classified mission that just lifted off. Rod joins us once again from California via Skype-to-Skype communication. Hi, Rod.
Good evening. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Likewise.
I don't know which one to start with. Well, let's start with the twins. I just find this rather interesting. Scott Kelly is now on the International Space Station in a mission that will have him up there for an estimated, 342 days. And what's interesting in his case is that his identical twin brother, who's also an astronaut, is on space. So we get to really compare what happens to a body because there's literally a control model on the ground.
Yeah, this is really an amazing thing they put together. And what luck for NASA that these two twins applied and were both accepted, right? these two Navy guys. So it's Mark and Scott Kelly. Now, Mark has since retired, so he's not an active astronaut anymore, but he obviously signed up and said, yeah, I'll participate in this. And then Scott's up there flying his fourth mission, and he's, you know, like all these shuttle guys, they walk in the room and it's kind of like the air gets sucked out and you're in the presence of this dramatic overachiever. And he's, you know, he's done three previous missions. They built part of the space station. They serviced the Hubble. And then he did two missions on the ground where he was in an underwater simulator doing all these deep dives and so forth. So he's kind of uniquely qualified to do this kind of long space mission simulation. And the idea behind this, as you pointed out, is to have a control mechanism, if you will, on the ground so you can see what happens to one person that spends a year at 1G down here on Earth and then a person that spends a year up in microgravity. And, you know, our bodies just aren't adapted to that. We've known for a long time, and especially with the Russians, because they have done a lot of long-duration missions, but we never had this comparative mechanism. So we've known for a long time that there's effects on the body. But there was always this doubt about, well, is it that individual and is it the way their genes are structured and so forth? So now we're going to have these genetically matched twins so we can look at it and say, okay, this is exactly, and some of this stuff is pretty dramatic. It's for a long time we've known there was bone loss. Density of the bone begins to decrease because there's no mechanical tension on the bones, right? You're not standing up. So that's why they have to do the treadmill for 2 or 3 hours a day with elastic straps pulling them down and all this stuff. And a lot of the calcium just leaves the body through urine and so forth. So their bones can actually become brittle pretty quickly if they don't do something about that. So that's a problem. The fluids, because there's no gravity, the fluids, which are normally in the lower half of your body, and we're adapted to deal with that on a daily basis, begin to redistribute. So most of the time you're up in space, you feel like you've got a head cold. You can't hear very well. You can't taste anything very well. And it even begins to impair your daily function a little bit. So that's been a long problem. Your blood changes. And the most recent thing that they've been a little alarmed about, I was talking to a NASA flight surgeon a couple months ago, and he said, you know, the eyes change shape.
Wow.
And
wow.
We're not even sure if it's temporary or permanent, because sometimes it can last for years and years. So the eye actually changes. I think it becomes more oblate. And so the focus changes and it doesn't always come back. So these are seemingly small things, but you can imagine between that and the increased radiation of going outside of the space station's only a couple hundred miles up, so it's still protected from most of the radiation in space. But you add to this the radiation that you're going to experience going out to Mars for 6 or 7 months one way, it's a pretty serious undertaking. So it's a big step towards these long-duration space flights to then be able to do this.
Now, they are identical twins, but I'm just kind of curious to know, there's a lot of training that has to go through, in the case Scott, has to go through to be a functioning astronaut before their launch.
Right.
Did Mark have to do a similar routine so that when Scott leaves, they are identical? In other words, muscle mass and body strength and all that stuff.
My understanding is that there was a regimen given him to more or less be consistent with what Scott was doing. But I don't think, you know, he's not held to it in the same way contractually, if you will. So I assume it's pretty close, but how exact that part is, I don't know. But I know that, you know, they've got a lot invested in this, so I'm sure it was pretty profound.
And I would assume during the course of the year that they're going to, I mean, I don't think he's sitting in a lazy boy chair for the year that his brother's up in space.
No. No, so they're looking for more profound changes. I mean, you know, Mark's got to be able to live his life, so it's not like he's going to be kept in a, you know, locked in a closet for a year. But in general terms, what they're looking for is stuff that's more basic to the human mechanism, you know.
In other words, just to see what the changes are, as you were describing earlier, that will happen to Scott that clearly won't be happening to Mark.
Yeah, so you don't want Mark to be doing, you know, skydiving every day for 2 hours a day, because it's going to kind of mess up their results a little bit. I don't think he's got that planned.
Okay. Now, one of the other things, the other story I wanted to touch on was that launch that took place, the X-37B, which is a mystery shuttle that basically took off the other day.
Yeah, it was really a mystery when it started. It's a little less of a mystery now, but this is an Air Force craft, and the Air Force has been trying to get a winged spacecraft up since about 1959. They wanted to follow on the X-15 program, which was their hypersonic, not quite into orbit, hypersonic plane that they were flying in the late 50s, early 60s. They wanted to follow that up with something called the X-20, which was going to be like a little space shuttle that launched on top of a Titan instead of an Atlas like this one did. But it, you know, it wasn't dissimilar in concept, except that it had a crew. And that was eventually supplanted by plans for the space shuttle. And so the Air Force, as happened many times over, did not get their space program. But as the years have gone on, it's become more obvious that space is kind of the high ground for the military and these things are needed. So they, years ago, with NASA, started working on the predecessor to this. And it's a small, it's about a quarter the size of the space shuttle we all know, a small unmanned shuttle that sits on top of a rocket instead on the side, inside a fairing, and goes up and deploys, and it can stay up there for over a year, which is really pretty wild when you think about it. And then it comes down and lands itself at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, and they hose it off and clean it up and check everything and launch it again.
Now, it's interesting that as we call it a secret shuttle because it went up and it's a classified mission. But is this the bait and switch situation here, or follow the shiny object? Because everyone's talking about the X-37B, which went up, and we're not supposed to know about it, but we do know about it. But what else was in that payload?
Are we doing a coast-to-coast episode? No, I'm just kidding. we don't know what's in the payload bay. What was released was that there was a couple of earth sensing missions, and earth sensing can mean anything from looking at climate change to spying on the bad guys, so don't really know what that part is. But below it, because it's in a fairing at the top of the rocket, you know, the big cone up top that protects it during launch, but there's room below that, so they also launched 10 CubeSats, and those were civilian in nature, so that we do know something about. One of them is this solar sail project that the Planetary Society here in LA has been working on for, probably close to 20 years. And that's, you know, CubeSats are cool anyway, because they're about the size of two cigar boxes, and they go up there, and they're cheap to make, and they're light to launch, and they don't cost much compared to normal satellites anyway. And they can do a lot of stuff because you can, you know what you can do with your iPhone, so you put that circuitry in your CubeSat, and it can do amazing things. This one actually has little rods that extend and pull out sheets of Mylar with it. So it ends up being, I think, something like 325 square feet, and it's enough surface that when the light of the sun hits it, the pressure from the light is enough to drive it forward. So they're going to experiment with this and see how much acceleration it can reach and if they can navigate it properly and all that. And then JPL's got a couple of missions that are going up in a couple of years that are going to do the same thing out by the moon, and one of them also is going to go to an asteroid. So this is a really exciting area of space. They're slow. You know, this isn't a quick gratification mission. You get a solar sail going up there, and it's going to take years and years to get where it's going. But once it gets up to acceleration, they can go pretty fast.
Wow. Well, I bet if we get in contact with Edward Snowden in Russia, he'll tell us what else is on the payload.
Yeah, or Richard Hoagland. I'm sure he'd have a few ideas, too. But he'll be talking about faces on Mars in no time.
Is this enough, and this is the last question I'm going to ask you here, is this enough to get people excited? And the reason why I say that is whenever you hear astronauts talk about why they became astronauts or why they wanted to go into space, they can pinpoint the moment when they were children as to a certain thing that took place involving NASA that said, that's what I want to do. Is that happening now with kids today?
You know, that's a fantastic question, and I'll try and keep my answer brief, but I did a talk at a conference here in LA called the Space Tech Expo yesterday that was about that very question. And it really, to put it in simple terms, it's selling space. How do we sell space better? And if you talk to people at places like JPL and Johnson and the Cape now, a lot of them say, you know, my transformative moment was seeing my first shuttle launch, because most of them weren't alive when Apollo went up. Or the other half of them say my transformative moment was seeing the third Star Wars movie, because a lot of them got into it because of Star Wars. How you get people motivated now is a tough question. I just saw a statistic the other day that something like half of Americans think that NASA's budget is 24% of the federal budget. It's a half of 1%. If it's 24%, we'd be out at Alpha Centauri already. So there's a big perception gap there, and how to close that, I don't know. I think this mission will get a lot of people's imaginations going, but it's still not quite like going to Mars. I mean, that's going to be the real tipping point, I think, is when they get serious about that.
Which, by the way, is the title of your book, Curiosity, an inside look at the Mars rover mission and the people who made it happen. Thought I'd get that in there.
Now we got to figure out a way to put people on those rovers, and we got it made, huh?
Exactly. Well, we sent the car up, you know. We might as well use it.
That's true. Take a couple of seats, and you got it going. That's right.
Rod, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks once again for talking to us.
Thank you much.
NASA expert Rod Pyle. He's also the author of Curiosity, an Inside Look at the Mars Rover Mission and the People Who Made It Happen. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0301, and you'll find the link to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
If you're listening to this while walking with your iPod, make sure you look both ways before you cross the street. It's safety first on The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The Millennial Woman. Plus, we'll discuss the issue of whether it's a good idea or not to friend your boss on Facebook. Stick around for that. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day and lots more Stuff File news right here, right now. On a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a group of males with swords robbed two different pizza delivery men over a weekend at the same address in the Spring Grove Village neighborhood of Cincinnati. The first man was delivering for Domino's on a Saturday night when four males with swords approached him, police said. One suspect held a sword to the man's throat and took money from his pockets. The attackers fled on bicycles. In a separate incident, another man encountered a group of three sword-wielding males on Sunday night while delivering pizza for La Rosa's. Now, while investigating that robbery, police were told by a neighbor that several of his swords were recently stolen from his home. Later that week, police arrested a suspect in connection with the two incidents. The arrest was at the suspect's grandmother's home, according to Lieutenant Dan Ogilvie. The house is also where the robberies occurred. Now, considering the brilliance of the cunning plan, it is not surprising that the suspect is 13 years old. Police are still searching for two more suspects. Wow. Do you think a life of crime is just the beginning for that 13-year-old? Yeah, he's on the fast track, don't you think? Okay, here's a quote. This is actually a text, a series of texts. Are you ready? God, I want you right now, John Dial texted. I wish you could have me right now, Katie Graham said in a reply. Dial texted back, we'll have my way with you and leave you quivering. On the other hand, Dial tells her later, you have always been disappointed when she asked him to take care of me. Dial, who is 49, was, emphasis on was, the Republican Speaker of the Missouri State House of Representatives. And Graham, 19, is a college freshman and was working as an intern at the state capitol. In screenshots of the text, it can be seen that Graham changed the congressman's name in her phone from John to Frank Underwood, the name of the fictional congressman turned president on the TV show House of Cards, who has an affair with a younger woman. Oh, by the way, did I say congressman turned president? I should have said spoiler alert, but anyway, too late now. Let's move along. When the Kansas City Star published the messages, Dial, a pro-family values Republican who is married and has three children, because they're always pro-lifers who do this, isn't it? Anyway, he resigned. The Missouri Southern State University has already pulled all of its interns out of the Capitol. Now, again, as I said, why is it that so many politicians who work to legislate morals can't live up to their own edicts? And don't you want to be a fly on the wall at the next Dial family dinner? Gotta be some great conversations going on there, huh? Yeah. Anyway, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration wanted to use a truck in part of a sting against a drug cartel. So, according to Craig Patty, the owner of a small trucking company in Houston, Texas, it took one of his and it didn't ask for his permission. The DEA arranged for Lawrence Chapa, who was working for the agency as an informant and also for Patty's company as a truck driver, to haul marijuana, but Chapa was ambushed by cartel soldiers. He was killed, and the truck, one of only two the company had, was left bullet-ridden, splattered with blood, and out of service for almost 3 months. And Patty said he was afraid the cartel would think he was working with the DEA. Patty tried suing the federal government, but a federal judge didn't let the case reach trial. It's not just that you can't sue the federal government, said one of Patty's lawyers, but that fed law enforcement agencies under this ruling can use anybody's property to do anything they want to further their law enforcement mission and not have to get the permission from the owner of the property to do it. Yeah. Anybody see anything wrong with this? Anyone? Anyone? Bueller? You know, I'm not really a great fan of lawsuits, but I think this is one that really needs to go all the way to the Supreme Court. I mean, seriously, why don't taxpayers just stop paying for police vehicles and just let them take any car they want? It's basically what they're doing now, or at least they can, if they wanted to. Yikes. Anyway, we have one more Stuff File news story to get to right now before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A man in Florida grabbed his cell phone when he saw 25-year-old Jonathan Restrepo jump out of his girlfriend's car into traffic. He was running around like a monkey with his tongue out, waving arms in the air, jumping on top of cars, the man said. He started taking video as Jonathan jumped onto several cars, and then one car didn't stop. The car continued down the highway with Jonathan scrambling around the roof on his knees and peering in the window at the terrified driver. Police stopped the car by coming in the opposite direction on the highway, and Jonathan finally jumped off and ran. He ran a few feet and then ran back at them, the man who shot the video said. He was really confused, just acting crazy. I've never seen anything like it. Officers were able to apprehend Jonathan, who allegedly told them that he was using crystal meth and that someone was after him. He was arrested on charges of public intoxication, disorderly conduct, and criminal mischief for causing more than $1,000 in damage to two different cars. You know, that's the thing about drug-induced paranoia. If someone's not after you, they will be soon. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Millennials seem to have a different attitude about work than previous generations. They live by the term YOLO, you only live once, and aren't necessarily concerned with the term job security or work for retirement. So how does one navigate in this current culture? On the line with us right now is Terry Lazell, author of The Millennial Woman, How to Achieve Success for the New Woman Within. She's on the line with us right now from New York. Hi, Terry.
Hi, how are you doing? Here?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks for being on the program with us. So you are a millennial.
Yeah,
you are,
I am.
You are in this age group. We are in an era of freelance these days. Was this something you came to organically, or was this just the kind of person you always were?
I definitely, it's organic. I mean, this was a situation. We were just coming out from the Great Recession, so, I mean, it was difficult to get a job. Most millennials are actually the most educated generation in history, but we're still stuck. So I pretty much fought my way out of it and came out on top and wrote my book to help people from getting stuck, unstuck.
So what was the first step in fighting your way out of it? I guess first of all, realization that you are kind of stuck in a rut, but what's the first step out?
The first step out is actually being aware that you're stuck and you want to do something about it. It's not just like, oh, I'm stuck, you know, I'll stick it out for a couple years. It's more like, I got to do something about it today. I was working for a company, and it was a Fortune 500 company, and I just couldn't take a lunch because for some reason, customer service, I couldn't. And I was like, why did I put myself in a situation where I can't take a lunch? So like 3 days later, I said, hey, guys, I need to go part-time, figure out my life. I moved to New York City, and I'm going to my dream fashion school. And I've been living out my dream ever since. So it was just a decision, really. That's what it is.
Okay, so you moved from where to New York?
From Miami. I'm a Miamian.
Okay, so there's certain when people hear the term moving to New York, you know, there's the old saying, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. But when you're starting out, New York, very first of all, is an expensive place to live. So if you're just starting out, where do you begin in New York City when you just get there?
It's a funny story. I'm glad you asked. Actually, I made a decision. I said I will never work a job that I hate, period. And I my very first job in New York City, I was actually blowing balloons because I was like, I will blow some balloons. But then eventually I was able to be a fashion consultant and work for a fashion firm. And we launched a couple really good lines as well. So,
okay. So I mentioned the title of your book, The Millennial Woman, How to Achieve Success for the New Woman Within. First of all, do the principles within your book, do they differ from what a millennial man would have to do, or is it unique to just women?
Not necessarily. This book is pretty generic. I just decided to focus on the woman because I'm a woman. I can talk for women. But any man, if they read this book, they're going to get a lot of nuggets from it. And, you know, I might be a little bit girly. Can I talk about boyfriend and queens and all that stuff? But other than that, the principles are pretty basic and common.
I also mentioned in the introduction the term YOLO, you only live once, which you know, somebody, I'm a back-end baby boomer. Anybody of my generation, some of us might cringe at the idea. it's a double-edged sword. Cringe at the idea of thinking that way and be somewhat envious of the fact that we didn't think that way.
Yeah. There's a big difference in the generational mindset. We pretty much saw our parents get laid off and like companies are just, you know, working our parents. And then when we get out of college, we're like, you don't care about our retirement. We got no pension. So, you know, we want to like live our lives. We want to travel. We want to do things because we saw that didn't happen for our parents. So we just really want to live life. And that's a big difference is like, you know, that corporate America is having, like how to work with the millennial mindset. So
do you think just generally speaking, not, you know, for your generation alone, but just generally speaking, do you think freelance is the wave of the future?
Definitely. I really think that we're kind of getting back to our roots. Initially, before the 1900s, most people were entrepreneurs until the, of course, industrial movement happened. And a lot of, you know, companies blew up and throughout the 1900s and a lot of firms, you know, like job firms kind of got together and people wanted pension and security. And I feel like we're kind of moving our way back to being an entrepreneur because we can't rely on the corporate system to help us. So it's more of a necessity, and I feel like because of the new age of internet, it's much easier nowadays.
Okay, so as you say, as a millennial, you've seen situations where your friends or your parents' friends or got laid off, or I should reverse that, your friends' parents got laid off, maybe your parents got laid off, you see jobs around you falling apart. What is affecting millennials is not only affecting just millennials. Do you see the advice you have to offer in your book is something that, for instance, an older generation who might want to start over, as they say, it's never too late. Is it good advice for them too?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I hope that as being a millennial that I'm, starting over is a way that anyone in any generation could feel that they can start over too. It's not about feeling stuck, and no matter how old person is, they can't live out their dreams. Anyone can live out their dream at any age. It's just about making that decision. So my principles in my book can help anyone, and that's the reason why I wrote it, because I'm actually living out my dreams. I've traveled around Europe. I paid for it myself. I had investments. I did so many good things. I'm only 26. So I was just like, I need to write a book so people can live out their dreams too. So.
Just the idea. I mean, the fact that you wrote a book is the back end of everything you've done up until now. But there's a pattern here, and that pattern is you seem to be a go-getter. You seem to be a self-starter. And, we can give tags to an entire generation, but within every generation, there are some people who are not self-starters. How do you speak to them?
The ones that are not self-starters is only because may I have a belief or a doubt that they can't really achieve their dreams, or they don't have a dream, or they're not in a circle where people are achieving things. And I really think that it's just anyone can achieve their dreams. So if they get the fire in their heart that, I can do this and I have no doubt, it can spark a fire within anyone.
So are you someone who's lived without doubt, or do you just acknowledge it and step around it?
Well, doubt happens to everyone. I am no exception. It's just all about the techniques that's used, which I definitely describe in my book. I call doubt in my book Sir Doubt because I like to use the analogy of a queendom or a kingdom to conquer the people in your court that wants to throw you off, like Sir Doubt. And I really address doubt. It's this book is a complete workbook and almost like a self-evaluation of what's going on and what those beliefs are that are hindering you from really reaching out and going past your dreams.
So you've worked in the fashion industry. You've written this book. Have you achieved your goals, or are your goals always evolving and changing?
Oh, man. It was the very first time I got to New York. I was like, wow, okay, what else is next? It was the first time I had to think past my dream because I hit it. And it's an evolving ceiling, pretty much. Like, once I hit the ceiling and I break through, I got to find the other ceiling to break through. And that it's a journey. Definitely, I'm evolving.
Now, it seems like you are a fearless person. As you say, you've traveled. You've done what you pretty much wanted to do. You've written this book. Do you come from fearless parents or quite the opposite?
Well, you know what? My mom, she's a top salesperson. And she said, one time I brought home straight C's when I was a kid, and she was so upset. She was just like, you see this? She's Trinidadian, so she's a Caribbean woman. You see this? I'm number one in my company for my division in all of America, and you bring home C's? So we were grounded for months, And she just allowed me, anything I said I wanted to do in life, didn't matter how silly it was. I said, Mom, I want to be in an agency and be a model, and I'm only 15. I don't know where the thought came from, but she's like, okay. And she'll just take me there, she never doubted me, even though, she just never made me believe I couldn't do anything.
Well, it sounds like you could write another book. And the reason why I say that is you just touched on something that I think shows a lot of your drive. You said your parents are from Trinidad. My parents are from Barbados. You could probably write another book that says, Diary of an Immigrant Child, because there's a lot of stick-to-itiveness and go-get-itiveness in immigrant children, no matter where their parents are from.
Yeah, yeah. That's true. I'm actually the first generation born in America. But everyone else, my entire family is over there.
I know the feeling. I know the feeling well. The book is called The Millennium Woman, How to Achieve Success for the New Woman Within. Terry, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program. People can find more information by going to themillennialwoman.com, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And I have a really special dream catching worksheet at the back of the book. It's life-changing, so please take a look.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Terry, for being on the show.
Thank you.
Terry Lizelle, author of The Millennial Woman, How to Achieve Success for the New Woman Within. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0301, and you'll find links to Terry's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. A new survey reveals that companies in the U.S. are facing more than twice as much litigation as companies in other countries. That bears repeating because there are so few studies that compare the level of litigation in America with other countries. So, here it is again. Last year, U.S. companies had to defend themselves against more than twice the number of lawsuits as companies in other countries. The survey was conducted by the third largest law firm in the world. Let's be fair, it's no surprise to hear that the U.S. is the most lawsuit-happy country on earth, but the survey also revealed an alarming fact about just how quickly these litigation costs are rising. The number of U.S. companies spending at least $10 million a year on their lawsuit budgets soared nearly 50% in just the last 2 years. With the U.S. government reporting that the economy slowed to a crawl in the most recent quarter, the last thing job seekers need is companies having to divert money from job creation into fighting lawsuits. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about whether or not it's a good idea to friend your boss on Facebook. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. And we have one more Stuff File news story to get to before we get to our next guest here on The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio. Well, what use does a dead man have for a stripper? It's to give them face, explained a Chinese villager. And no, that's not anything rude. That's why strippers are hired to perform at funerals. Otherwise, no one would come. And well-attended funerals are culturally associated with good fortune beyond the grave. In an investigation nearly a decade ago, the government-run China Central Television discovered a dozen groups offering funeral strippers in just one county. This has severely polluted the local cultural life, it said. Now, recently, after a picture showing a stripper performing in front of children went viral, the government made an arrest, and the Ministry of Culture has promised a crackdown. You know, if the culture calls for a crowd, and the strippers draw a crowd, isn't a practice of hiring strippers just the culture adapting? Think about it. Just think about it. And while you're thinking about it, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Is it a good idea to friend your coworkers or your boss on Facebook? What if you are the boss? Should you be friends with your subordinates? That's the question we put to Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, who's a research psychologist, psychoanalyst, and author of What Price Power? An In-Depth Study of the Professional Woman in a Relationship. She's back on the program again and joins us on the line from New Jersey. Hi, Dr. Frieda.
How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
Sure. So, I always enjoy it.
So,
thank you.
Glad you like it. So, let me ask you the question right off the bat. Should we be befriending our bosses on Facebook and vice versa? Should bosses be friends with subordinates?
You know, that's a really difficult question. It's not as obvious as it looks because it really does depend on the climate of the workplace. So if it's something where it's accepted, if you and your boss get along, if you don't want to feel that you need to hide something that you don't want to reveal about your personal life. So all this comes into play because, you know, you become an open book when you do something like this. So it can get you closer together or it can reveal things about you that you may not want to be revealed.
Now, there is a gray area, I think, here in that you could have a very fine working relationship with your boss, which is wonderful, and your coworkers. But you yourself might decide, well, I like to keep my private life private. So if your boss sends a friend request and you don't respond by friending your boss, could that be problematic?
It depends how you explain it. It could be more problematic if you allow him to follow through. After all, the whole concept here is to be able to connect, to communicate, and to have approval from your boss. So we need to set the prerequisite in the right direction. It can be more effective, and people can perform better if they feel understood, if they feel that there's a social relationship. That's very good for those people. So it depends what you're doing socially. If he's going to open your Facebook and he's going to see you having a few drinks too many, or may not like the crowd that you hang out with, or maybe you took a day off from work and forgot to take it off Facebook, you know, it's something that you have to really be careful about. But 57% of executives said that they were uncomfortable about being friends with people they manage. And one study found that people felt it was like a parent reaching out to them. So you see, that does happen. There's a feeling of being watched by someone that could be judgmental. So if your boss is someone that you enjoy being with, if you go out for a few drinks with him, if you have dinner with him, and you are someone who is connected to that person, that's something else entirely. But I don't know how many relationships, how many people have that kind of opportunity.
Now, it's interesting to just say that surveys say that people don't like situations where they have someone in their life who might be judgmental. I find that an interesting dichotomy, because you have people who are out on Facebook who, let's be honest, TMI. There is just too much information. So if you're worried about being judged, why put so much stuff out there?
Well, people are wondering about that themselves, and it seems to be that they're not happy about Facebook. It's causing depression, competition. I mean, if you're single and you see a friend getting married or having children, how does that make you feel? Or if somebody's going on vacation and you can't afford it, you know, that's not the best feeling either. So people put the best of themselves out there. I remember I was on this party bus a few years ago, and this woman who was drunk is falling to the ground, and as she's falling, she's taking a picture of herself for Facebook. So that's how ridiculous this whole thing is. Everybody wants to show themselves in a certain way. But it's just a microcosm of events, and people should not take it too seriously. But then you can find out things about other people, too. What do they celebrate? Who are they close with? I know someone is looking for a house. They're Facebooking people, and I think this is really extreme. People's backgrounds, to see who these people are, who their neighbors are. So you know more about these people before you move in than people who actually live there. So Facebook has a lot of negativity to it. It's wonderful if you connect to your relatives. It's wonderful if you connect to your friends, but only to those people that you want to expose it to. After all, if you go to college, you know, they could check you up on Facebook too and see what it's all about. And I recommend a lot of these students, probably most of these students, should not have a Facebook for that reason alone.
That brings up an interesting point. And going back to the bosses thing, I was going to ask the question about age. And do you think that what we're talking about here is just purely generational? And the reason I say that is your bosses probably are older than you are and come from a different mindset, a different background, a different era when Facebook wasn't and Twitter wasn't the norm for everybody. I'm just wondering if you have a younger boss, if you have a young company where everybody is in that same generation period where it's not unusual to put up everything on your Facebook page, that having stuff that might be deemed negative on your Facebook page won't be such a big deal to someone who is making decisions from a younger perspective.
You know, that's an excellent question, and you're extremely insightful to ask that question. Because my study, my research has shown that the people who are working for the boss prefer it, and they're probably younger, and they like that connection. And it's the executives and the people that are in charge that do not like this. They're uncomfortable with it, with this. So that's true. Generational boundaries and different points of view is a big part of this as well. So that's extremely, that's a very good question.
So do you think, maybe in 20 years, this, what we're talking about right now, won't even be an issue, assuming in 20 years there still is a Facebook and a Twitter and these things are still around?
You're right. Only if we look at Facebook differently. If we realize it's going to be used in the workplace, we won't connect the two. And maybe they should have another site, one for work and one for your personal life. So you can go ahead and tell people about yourself in a way that they think that this group would be interested in this part of your life and another group would be interested in another more personal part of your life. So it's very likely that this is going to go in that direction because it's already leading to questions about whether this kind of Facebook should be accepted in the workplace. So the answer is we need to have two different sets of groups and activities that are appropriate for your personal life and one for your work life.
Okay, so we've discussed the issue of whether or not you should be friends with your boss on Facebook or whether you should be friends with your subordinates on Facebook. But what about in the hiring practice? What if somebody is going through a job interview and the person who is hiring says, "Can I see your Facebook page?" Are you allowed to, or do you think you have a right to say no?
Do you have a right to say no? You have a right to say everything you want to say, but will it get you the job?
Yeah.
People like, you know, people like transparency. They like to know that they can trust you, that everything's above board. So, yes, and that's the problem. What you put on Facebook needs to be censored because they are doing this, as I said. They're doing this in colleges. They're looking you up. They're wondering who you are. Do you do volunteer work? Are you involved with sports? Are you religious? What is your orientation? Are you family-oriented? All these things they can find out about you. Do you have economical concerns? So even that is shown often on Facebook because people connect and have these open discussions with one another. So, yes, they're allowed to do this. If you say no, you'll be suspect to something. So you have to prevent this from being a problem to begin with. And when you do say yes, be careful. Now, as you said, it is generational as well. If you have someone, and when you're interviewed, you have something in common, well, people like to be with like people. Do you know when you go in for an interview, and I don't know if this is off the topic, but maybe not, pertaining to your question, if you dress like the people that are interviewing, then they think you're more one of them. If your Facebook represents the lifestyles that they have, then you become more like one of them. Hmm. So that is really something that needs to be thought about and planned out. And perhaps even go to the extent of finding out about people that you will be working with or are working with already so you can bring in something that they would support and that's something that is similar to them. That would get you a lot of brownie points.
It's interesting that, you know, somebody looking to hire could go through your Facebook page, but that is a two-way street. If I'm looking to be hired, I can go through my potential employer's Facebook page as well, I guess.
You can even find out the income.
There you go.
You can find out if they're divorced. You can find out where they've been on their last vacation. Anything you want to know that they won't tell you, you could find out.
It's interesting that we live in a world where people are always concerned about Big Brother, but in reality, we ourselves are volunteering the information that is supposedly Big Brother. So there you go. Dr. Frieda.
But we're confused. What can I tell you?
Exactly. Dr. Frieda, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for being with us once again.
Thanks a lot. Take care. Be well. Bye-bye.
Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, author of What Price Power? An in-depth study of the professional woman in a relationship. You can check out her website at drfrieda.com. And of course, you'll find the link on my website at thestufffile.com. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
59-year-old Joseph Larry Lopez of Riverdale, Utah, allegedly hired 40-year-old David Allen Northcutt to kill his daughter's boyfriend. Now, usually in these stories, the alleged hitman is an undercover police officer, but for once, this isn't the case. But the scheme still came to police attention after Lopez got upset at Northcutt for not completing the task as agreed and demanded his money back. The men got into an argument, and both men, I repeat, both men called police to come to settle it. Once officers figured out the basis of the argument, they arrested both men. Police didn't report on why Lopez wanted his daughter's boyfriend killed, however. But you know, really, that's irrelevant, because you have to ask the question, if you have engaged in a murder conspiracy and the plan falls through, and then you get into a fight with your co-conspirator, then why, oh why, would you call the police to settle the dispute? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0301. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0301. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.